Today, I'm going to be asking Louis some questions about food and plants and animals in the Sahuatmec area and how those were harvested and prepared for eating. Louis, are you hungry?
not right now.
Well, I'm curious about some of the plants because I've talked to you before about plants like wapato and supilali. And I know that you've told us stories about how some of those were prepared, but I'm curious about how they were preserved and then how they were harvested and what kind of materials you used to harvest and things like that. So let's talk about the wapato first. You're doing a lot of work around wapato right now, so kind of feels right to...
Well, I was involved in fishing originally. And now our salmon are gone, so I was up my sweat house, and when I was leaving it, the plants told me, we're going to leave you if you don't need us anymore. So I switched from salmon over to plants, our food that we ate traditionally, because I keep talking about that now, and they're slowly disappearing. Because you got to remember, too, you know, that this area is known for its supilali, the Indian ice cream. And there's hardly any left now. It totally disappeared. I think the farms took it over, and we're not looking after it like we did for centuries. So naturally, they're going to disappear. And this is what I keep saying, you know, we have to start looking after them like our people did for centuries, you know, and it was food that's available to us, and it could be available to anybody, because I think they're more healthier, and, you know, people just have to adapt to eating that source, and a lot of our people broke away from it, you know, the root crops. I find that a lot of people go out and harvest the huckleberries and saskatoons because they're better tasting and sweeter, and but yet they forgot about all the other crops that our people ate, you know, like the avalanche lily, the chocolate lily, and all of the other ones. And if we're not looking after it, they're going to disappear, because when I was up at harvesting up at Nisqually, we've been harvesting up there for quite a few years now. And me and my mother would go up and we'd harvest up there. And I started noticing some areas, the avalanche lily disappeared from it. And the roots are getting smaller and smaller. I don't know what the reason is behind it. Maybe because we're not tilling the soil like we did for thousands of years, and not looking after it. And I think this is one of the main problems that we're having. And you got to remember, too, you know, that when we were tilling the soil, because we had to feed up to 10,000 people at one time, so naturally they were kind of building a fire guard up in the hillsides, you know, tilling the soil and keeping the grass down, with a lot of the fires are from grasses. So it had its purpose a long time ago. And I think that something that could be looked at now, mm-hmm. to help prevent some of the fire from spreading. And especially near communities, you know, it would really help out a lot. And I think this is what we have to strongly look at. And I think that, you know, it's our people harvested a lot of avalanche lily, chocolate lily. I'm trying to think of all the other root crops. The wapato, especially the wapato. That one is harvested late in the fall. And it disappeared from our delta here because they're heavily reliant on water.
So tell us a little bit about how wapato grows.
Well, I can't remember what the centimeter is, about a foot of water. It grows, thrives more healthier and Because we transplanted, or Ann Garibaldi transplanted some down there in a swamp there, and then the swamp dried out, and the plant itself started getting spindly. And so I think that the roots were getting smaller too. So it's a crop that's grown pretty well, I think, in North America. And it may be in Europe, I'm not too sure, but I don't know whether it's an introduced species or what. But it totally disappeared from the delta here because we weren't, the river changes its course so many times. And what we got to do is somehow channel it and look after it a heck of a lot better because the plants that they brought out, there was about 1,000 plants, I guess, that estimated from the 36, I think, that she brought. And
and when was that?
Oh, that was quite a few years ago. I'm trying to think of what year it was. But because some of the people said, oh, well, yeah, some of your wapato is down at the canoe. It floated down there and started developing. So you can imagine it's maybe we're spreading seeds always through down to the coast.
So it needs about a foot of water. Yeah. And that would mean, like, so the area that you've talked about that Samnarm Downtown is built on, that was all filled in, that would have been perfect because it was consistently bogland there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. And it grew quite a bit down the delta, and our people was always down there harvesting them in the fall time. Because I think those are pretty well one of the last root crops that they dug up. And the earlier ones are usually around May, June. Hmm. May and June.
How was the wapato harvested? Like, how did you dig it up?
Well, they either reached down and dug it out by hand, or probably had a long digging sticks to pry them out, because they, when you're digging them up, they kind of pop out. Because my grandmother was saying, she was telling stories of it, and she was saying that she used to use her toes and dig it around with their toes, and they'd float to the top of the water.
Hmm.
So it was readily available to the people, and it was, that's how they found out that it grew down there, because she was telling stories of it. And they decided to bring some down there and see what would happen, and they took right off. Hmm. I was, after they planted it, I forgot about it because they put little cages around it. And that couple of years later after they planted, I went down there, I forgot about it. And then I went down there and had a look, the cages were still there. And the ducks were using them for roost. They were sitting on the little chicken wire cages they had, trying to protect the bulbs. And there was nothing under them. So I started walking away, and then all of a sudden I looked around the shoreline there. I guesstimate at that time was about 500 plants.
Hmm.
They grew really good down there. And but I still laugh at when the ducks were sitting up on the wire cages there, laughing at me probably. Crazy Indian. Didn't you know that they floated around the seeds? So, but yeah, they really took off. And I just went down there last week, and they're going away again.
Hmm.
Where they were really growing heavy, there's nothing growing there. There was just spotty now.
So there's a lot of canary grass in that area too, isn't there?
Yeah.
Does that choke it out?
I don't really know what's the reason why, but it seemed to grow pretty good when it was there, because I think the bulbs either float away or the seeds. Because when it gets when the high water comes up, it then when it recedes, I don't know whether the bulbs get out or what, but something, maybe it could be, because we haven't, it's a new kind of a new potato that left us for about 80 years. So we don't know that much about it, so it's going to take some studying to really look at it. Maybe you got to bring Aaron Garibaldi back, the guru on Wapato.
So what kind of food is it? It's like a potato.
Yeah, it's a root crop.
And did you boil it? Did you dry it? Like what?
Well, it's the only way we could preserve all our root crops was to dry them, sun dry them. And they're all sun-dried and stored away for the winter. And you can eat it fresh, any of the root crop, you can eat it fresh, you know. But I don't know whether it changes the food value in it or not. But I don't think so. You know, maybe it adds some different type. Because there are some roots that are poisonous to us. When we eat it, we get a bad reaction out of it. But if you either sun dry it or bake it in ground pit cooking, it'll change the food value and then becomes edible. I don't know. I haven't really studied too much on root crops because I'm more or less the builder of our culture, you know, the sweat house, pit house, and all of that. And my mother was the one into plants, and I did go out with them sometimes and drove them around, her and Nancy Turner. Mm-hmm. And I guess I did pay a little attention because we had to stop about every half a mile and they see a plant on the side of the road and they want to stop and have a look at it and talk about it. So it was kind of fun, you know, just listening to them because they were both plant people, and I was just a driver at the time, but it was an experience. So that's why I enjoyed being their driver, because you know, just hear the laughter and talking about the history of the plants, and because you know it's the history of our people. That's what it is, you know, the history of our plants, and so I think that. To me, like I said, I should have paid more attention, but I'm too busy thinking about my other buildings and whatnot. But now I have to really relearn a lot of it. And it's taken some time, but I still remember some of it because my grandmother was still kind of, when I was growing up with her, she was still kind of drying the fruits, and mostly fruits. Huckleberries, blueberries, Supilali, Saskatoon, especially Saskatoons. They went modern. Instead of using the mats, the bulrush mats to dry them on, mm-hmm. The burlap sacks came in. What they did was they opened it up and washed it, and then they used that burlap to spread it out and dry the berries. Mm. And us kids used to go over there and help ourselves to a couple of handfuls and spread it back out again. And I think she knew that we were eating some of it, but we thought we were sneaky. We'd spread it out a little more after we take a handful out of it. Because they're really tasty, you know. You
oh, yeah.
Put some in your mouth and ate it. And but it was part of our life because, you know, they still lived the same way. Because when they asked her about the Hungry 30s. She said, what's that? You know, they still had root cellars. They dried a lot of their salmon, their deer meat, moose meat, the root crops. They dried them and hung them up down in their root cellars.
Mm.
So she said, what was that? And they talked about the Hungry 30s. You know, they still ate fairly good.
That would have been when early settlers were here, and there was trade and stuff, but not as developed, of course, as it is now. What would the land have been like in the 30s, before the farmers were given all of the acres to
settle? Was stumps and a lot of trees. So there's a lot of land clearing, and they were trying to make farmers out of our people, and so they worked off if they needed a harness or Bennett wagon or something like this. They went and worked with the farmers and worked off their Bennett wagon or whatever they were trading in. lot of it was big trees, stumps, and they were all taken out by hand. I think it was after the Second World War when stumping powder came into usage. Because my mother would talk about that. My uncle and them were blasting stumps, and they'd say, "Fire below," and they'd all have to lay on the ground, and when the stumps were blowing up. She remembers that, you know, and so it really helped on their clearing of the land. Mm-hmm. And now I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of our berry crops disappeared, you know, because of the clear land clearing and us not harvesting them anymore. So we have something, we have to share the blame with the farmers. But that was a part of the assimilation program, I think, to make farmers out of us and till the soil and water the crops. And mm-hmm. Because a long time ago, our people depended on Mother Nature to help us. We were there just to till the soil, and we let Mother Nature water it and look after it while we're not there.
Yeah. So. And when the berries, like I remember you telling me a long time ago how you would break the branches up the end of the supalali in order to kind of keep it from getting too straggly, and it would make more berries. Was that a typical kind of management
that's
technique?
What I was thinking, because I always wondered about that, like the cherry trees, the chokecherry trees, the Saskatoon, all the bushes. I think our people had a way of pruning them so they'd keep producing ripe berries, you know, good berries. And so when I was up Salmon River one time, I found a great big one little bush there full of Saskatoons, and they were big and juicy. I've never seen one like it. So there are probably a variety of them around, and it depends on the weather, the water usage, how much of the Mother Nature watered them, you know. So I think these are some of the things that nobody's really thought about studying, you know, and because we don't harvest them too much anymore.
Mm-hmm. Where do the Saskatoons grow in the area? Like, where now in Salmon Arm area were they?
Well, they grow just about the same place as all the plants. Well, they grow right up and down the Okanagan.
So they're pretty drought tolerant, aren't they? Like they.
Yeah, I think so. Same with the chokecherries. You see them all over. And I think it would, too, if it's more water, I think they have a tendency to be more bigger and more juicier, because I've always noticed that the ones like down the Okanagan, you know, the Saskatoons down there, they seem to be a bit smaller and not quite as tasty as the ones where there's plenty of water. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the things that have to be strongly looked at if we decide to get enough interest in it.
And supalali is also pretty drought tolerant, isn't it?
Yeah. I think they have a male and female plant. And I think it's like that with all the plants, you know. They have male and females because they have to look after each other. And if you get rid of one species there, you're probably going to have less. Because I noticed the our people harvested pin cherries, too. They're like a not a choke cherry, but it's another type of cherry. They're a little more pinker and small pits in them. And we have a field of them up above there, and they're all cherries grow on them. Maybe they're all male plants or all female plants. And so these are some of the things that we have to relearn again, part of our culture that our people did for centuries.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask some questions about preserving and harvesting. So what kinds of containers were used? Like once you dried the berries and dried the wapato, how would it be restored for the winter?
Well, our people were known for their basketry. So a lot of it was stored in big birch bark baskets. And you can actually make baskets out of bulrushes. You wove it together. Mm. And that was, I think, our plastic bags a long time ago. Because they're readily available, and you just wove it together, and it's like to mostly carry things, especially fish. When they went fishing, they used that as storing their fish, and you know how fish smells after a while, you know. So it was disposable bags, and that was why our people used it. It had many purposes, the bulrushes and the tulies, and just about everything that was available on the land was used for something that our people used. And I think every plant had a purpose. And this is why people like Nancy Turner, my mother, would always look at what were the uses of a lot of the plants, medicinal or edibles. And I think that's something that we could look at, because I remind people, you know, we talked about the Hungry 30s, and we have enough land right across Canada here to sustain ourselves. And when you think about it, because it sustained our people for thousands of years, so why can't it sustain all of Canada for the next few millenniums? Millenniums. Tongue twister there.
Yeah, it's true. If we understood what the needs are of the plants and made them come back, made them welcome again.
Yeah, or I know years ago, agroforestry was a big buzzword. And I think they come back with another word for it now. They're starting to look at it as instead of just taking the trees out, and they're trying to see how they can make the plants agree with one another. Instead of taking out all the trees and making a big wide open farm. So, because you know, when you think about trees and all of the other trees and the shrubbery, they keep the ground kind of moist. You know, it doesn't, you don't have to water as much when you think about it.
Yeah. And the mycorrhizae, like all the fungus that kind of connected all of the plants that helped each other, that shared nutrients with each other and water, would have been important if the, you know, the berries and everything were also in the forest.
Yeah. So there's a lot to be, I think, to be learned from it, because like I said, you know, it disappeared from our culture probably in the last couple of hundred years. Because when you think about it, you know, it wasn't that long ago when we were still living off the land, you know. So when you, whereas the Europeans have broken away from the land itself, you know, to understand the value of the Mother Earth. So we got to relearn a lot of things, I think.
I'm actually now curious about how you spent your winters, because now storing the food, harvesting and preserving and storing the food meant that you could stay in one place for the winter. You didn't have to travel all over the region to gather food. So then what did you do in the winter?
Well, that's, I think, a good question. You know, when we built pit houses to winter, we had to get out of the cold, you know, and when you know, the last 100 years, our weather pattern have changed drastically. And we used to have about 3 feet of snow, lots of cold weather. And I remember walking on top of the snow. I remember skating all over down the rivers and lakes. So winters have really changed. And because I remember my grandmother talking about pit houses. The last ones, I think, in this area was over by Canoe or Sunnybrae. That's where they wintered, all over there in White Lake and up in the Narrows, all along the Thompson. There was winter homes all over there, but there was none where we stay now. Because it's all bottomland, and if you, in the springtime, if you built on the bottomland, you'll have an indoor swimming pool. because then the water comes up. Because we built some down by the river there, and we went down there that one spring, and there's about a foot of water in the, inside the pit house. And I tell everybody that's my indoor swimming pool. But yeah, I think that what our people did, well, they had they stored a lot of their stuff underground, dug little pits all around near the winter homes, and stored their berries, their fish, and meat. They stored them in that, and sometimes they built little platforms up in trees to save it up there, and whenever they needed it, they went and got it. So that was their cupboard during the winter months. So, and a lot of it was stored in baskets, birch bark baskets usually. They made a birch bark was really one of our main containers. Everything was birch bark baskets were used all the time. They were used for storing clothes. And I think there's stories that they even used it to bury our people in. Whenever one of the people died, they went out and the elders went out and gathered enough bark to make baskets enough to contain a body. But I think this is a story I heard. I don't think archaeologists ever dug anybody up and see if there's still in a fetal position, but this is one of the stories I heard. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's one of the reasons why birch bark was used. And the other bark was pine, white pine. The baskets were made, stripped off, and they were made into baskets too, and that was our cooking pots. They put the dried roots in there, and then they put water in there, and then they heated stones, and they kept putting newer and newer hot stones in it till it cooked the roots that they were going to eat. So that was one of their earliest. And they asked my grandmother about it, but they already got into pots and pans from the traders already, so she only heard about it. So they didn't really believe that until they found one up at Salmon River there. Bark like that. It was so a lot of things. My grandmother was already pretty well colonized, too, so to speak. She had the pots and pans and all of that. So the old ways that she could only remember somebody talking about it, just like I am talking about certain things, you know, because I can't really, unless we find some evidence of the way it was, you know, like when I talked about the burials. And the only time they cremated was when the warriors were out on the war trails. If somebody got killed out there, they cremated the body and brought the ashes back for burial. So that was one of the things that I know about.
I'm so interested in what you did in the wintertime, because I know that there was a lot of storytelling, because that is a very amazing and beautiful part of the Sahuatmec culture is the stories and the Chiptaqula. So can you tell me more about how those stories got shared and told in the winter?
Well, you know, usually the villages were all kind of one family. So there was a lot of visiting each other, you know, to break that boredom. So I think in the evenings, because when I was staying with my grandparents, I remember that. And they had an old pot-bellied stove, you know, made out of a 45-gallon barrel. They cut a hole in front and they cut a hole on top for the stovepipe. And every evening, when the sun went down, Kolai lanterns were lit. And that's all you heard. all evening long was laughter, you know. And I don't hear that anymore, because I think this is the way it was all winter long with all our people back when they still lived in pit houses. And the laughter. And I was thinking, you know, that's the storytelling of the elders, or of anybody, especially the men a long time ago when they went out on the war trail. They came back and started talking about their fighting deeds and telling stories about how great a warrior he was, and some of the other stories like fighting with bears and wrestling with bears and whatnot. So there was a lot of laughter. Because when I was thinking about that one time when I was sitting up in my sweat house, you know, I tell people, you know, I could hear the echoes of laughter up and down the valley of all the old people, you know, because I remember some of it, the laughter. I tell people now when I go up there, all I hear is words of anger in many different languages, because I think when I think about it, that anger, I always talk about that, you know, yo'ult in our language, it rubs off on you. When you're mad, you go and you rub it off on somebody, and they go to somebody else, and they rub it off on them. So next thing you know, you have about 50 to 100 people angry. So I think this is what it's all about, because that's all I hear now, because, you know, our communication is so rapid now. We know what's going on the other side of the world. And that's all the news talks about, you know, is all the bad things. So naturally, you know what, it's going to rub off on everybody. We forgot how to laugh. We can't laugh at ourselves nowadays because we're so politically correct. Yeah, you know, it's the truth. I try to spread some Suwakmuk humor, you know, and that's what I call it, you know, to create a little laughter and try to bring a little bit of joy into somebody's life, which is the Suwakmuk way. I always call it Suwakmuk humor. But I think that all winter long that our people, when they were in the pit house, they visit one another, they brought out the food after they ate. All the kids would curl up in their fur blankets and listen to everybody, and then the drumming and singing would start probably, and storytelling. So this is what I think Suwakmuk life was about, because, you know, I still hear the echoes of laughter once in a while, because all my elders had it, you know, and so that's what winter was all about, you know.
And the drumming and the singing, you remember that?
No.
You don't remember drumming?
No, we never did ever drum and sing. My grandfather used to ride his Bennett wagon. That's all he'd hear him is humming songs until he'd go to sleep, and the horses knew where to go. They'd go right back to the barn after a while. He'd be there sleeping away. And the horses would park right by the barn because they knew where to go. That's how he used to bribe me to go down and stay with them for a week or so. You know, as a little kid, he used to say, "I'm going to get the boy." And that was me, because I was given to them supposedly to... It was part of the old ways. The eldest sons were given to the grandparents. And I think it was kind of to look after them when they got too old to hunt and gather. But nobody really explained it to us, because my oldest brother was given to my dad's side of the family. And he was mad at my mother for the longest time because he thought that, you know, she didn't want him. He even admitted it later on. But I was given to my mother's side of the family. They let me go back and forth. So whenever they got lonesome for me or something, he said, "I'm going to pick up the boy." So I'd spend a lot of time with them. After my mother and them left from Salmon Arm here, I had nowhere to go, so I stayed with my grandmother. And I think that's where... I learned a lot of things in growing up, and because it wasn't that long ago, I couldn't speak the language. You know, I tried and tried. I couldn't even speak it. And one day I started putting one, two words together. Next thing you know, it's Kalota wat lasawap mkchin. Kakayam kikchamziam akea has Kalotawa. So I said, it's got to be my grandmother that taught me how to speak the language. So there must have been a lot of the things they must have been teaching me. So it's that memory of them, of the old ways. Some of it was maybe stored back somewhere in my little pea brain that I have.
It's in there. Yeah. I know that there's a drum making tradition now. Is that a relearning of some of the drum making techniques and the songs that were so common before settlement in this area?
Well, that it got taken away from us. Because when I listened, I got tapes of my grandmother, and she's speaking Swapmucheen, both her and my mother. So I'm kind of using that as my teacher yet, so to relearn some of the words. She always referred to the priest saying we could do this or do that. You know, it was later on in life when I started relearning the culture a little bit. There was a lot of things that made sense to me. Because whenever she spoke Swapmucheen, it was just to me and our own people. But the minute a stranger came around, she stopped speaking. She reverted over to English. It didn't dawn on me until I started relearning the culture and why it isn't appearing. And I don't want to say the Catholic Church, but they were the ones that, because she referred to the priest every time. They said, oh, the priest said we couldn't do this or do that. So she referred it quite a few times in her talks when she was getting translated by my mother. So they had a fairly big influence on their assimilation program or whatever you want to call it. And how do we justify that? And I always wondered about that. You know, we can't blame the churches or settlers or anything like this, but we have to learn to adapt now. But what's going to happen to our culture? You know, we don't keep it alive as to who we are as Swapmuc people. And I think this is one thing that we have to relearn to understand where we came from. Otherwise, you know, we might not know where we're going. You know, when you think about it. It's something, I think, that not only our Swapmuc, but all the Kalmuk, all the natives right across North America and South America have to think about in order to keep their culture alive. It's something I think that we all have to look at. I always say, you know, we need help in reviving some of it because there's so much gaps in our culture now. Trying to relearn it is going to take probably my lifetime and somebody else's lifetime to relearn what was all lost.
It's a really challenging time because everybody is interested in Indigenous culture. Everybody wants to know the true history. And the real fact is a lot of that history was erased. Yeah. And the cultural objects were stolen, and so much was prohibited that it makes it hard for elders to even feel comfortable trying to remember cultural aspects.
Well, I tried to practice as much as I could. I go for my traditional sweats. I did a lot of fishing when I was growing up, because I could remember going up to Huppel when they still harpooned the spring or the Chinook. They went out in canoes and they're harpooning. Excuse me. But they went out, they built their smokehouses right up there. I remember barely remember as a little kid, probably about 5, 6, because somehow or another it stuck to me. And I could remember going along the riverbanks with a little spear, and I think that was part of my training to become a fisherman too. Because I'd walk along the riverbank and spear at twigs, leaves, and try to catch a little kokanee along the shore. And so that was part of the training, I think. And then, you know, when I think back on it, I never really seen any elders or anybody around me. So they might have been teaching me, must have taught me how to be careful around near the riverbank. Because you got to remember, back in the day, the river was deeper and a little more dangerous. Maybe, I don't know, I didn't know how to swim. But anyways, there was a lot of training went on with our young people in either becoming a fisherman or a hunter. And my grandmother and grandfather, my grandmother talked about it, how I caught my first fish. They had a little footbridge down by the Salmon River here. And they gave me the spear, and I was standing on it. And I speared that salmon, and I hit it too close to the tail, and it started fighting really hard. It kept going back and away, and I was getting pulled. The only way I could catch it was I jumped in up to my, probably about 3 feet of water. And my grandma was telling my grandfather, like, help the boy. He just sit there laughing at me. He's got to learn. So I jumped in, and I finally brought that salmon to the shore. And apparently they said I slept with that salmon because it was my first one by the fire. But yeah, that was my first experience in catching my first salmon. Ever since then, I used to catch about 200 in one night. And at that time, we didn't have deep freezes. Mm-hmm. So I gave away all that I could. And we still had lots left over. So I got curious about preserving it, so I asked my grandmother how to smoke it. So she taught me how. And I and my brother were opening them up, getting it ready for smoking. You know, I didn't want to overwork her, so we'd chase her back in the house, and she'd take her knife and she'd go back in the house. And a little while later, she'd be out back again, because I think that need to keep practicing your culture was, you know, it brought back probably a lot of memories of how it used to be, because that was the first time we ever smoked in a long time. Mm. We didn't have smoked salmon when we were growing up, really, because it was illegal to fish down the river. And when we were fishing a long time ago, I think back in the 50s, I think it was 8 or 9 years old, 10, around there, fish warden caught us. They said they were going to try to take away the spear on me and Wabbits or Victor August. We wouldn't let him, so he said he was going to get the RCMP. So he left us there, and he went walking along the tracks and back into town. He got the RCMP, because after he left, we put away the spears and we took away the salmon, and then we started driving out, because my dad was sitting on the car there. He was drinking beer because he just got out of the army, and alcoholism was starting to get rampant back in the day. So as we're leaving, just getting on the reserve road there, the RCMP met us, and they charged my dad fishing out of season. So when they had a lawyer from Vancouver, they were fighting for title and rights. And we said, well, you could beat it, because, you know, me and Victor August were saying we were the ones fishing. Said, no, I want to fight for our title and rights, see if we can get her, make it legal for us to go fishing for our own selves again. But it never did happen. He ended up getting a $35 fine. And ever since then, I was kind of mad at DFO or fisheries. Because when I went fishing, I went down there and we had a 3-odd-3. And every once in a while, I'd fire off a shot because I was young and a little bit angry. So every once in a while I'd fire off a shot to let them know I was down there. They never did bother me, but I used to catch up to 200 a night. And it was fishing that was part of our culture, you know.
So were you using a spear to catch all 200 of those?
Yeah.
Wow.
Sometimes I'd use two spears because I built a footpath and have two spears, catch one and put them together and throw them on the bank. And coho were weird. you're standing on a footpath, and you got a, we had a gas lantern then. The light, we put a shield on it, it won't blind us. And then when, so that way you could see when the salmon come up, you weren't blinded. Mm. And you're on that footpath, and all of a sudden you look down, you could see something moving underneath you. Those damn things would swim back down and wait underneath the bridge there, so you got to be more aware of them too. At that time, we had quite a few going up there. Mm. And salmon was a, it was a coho, a lot of coho. I really liked the coho. Mm. One time I was skating in the Jackson when I was going to school over there. I'd go down to the pond and skate out in the pond and go out to the river and skate right over to the wharf, put my shoes back on and go to Jackson. As I was skating down there that one winter there, I looked in the ice and there was a salmon frozen right in it. I didn't think of it then, you know, it was frozen, it was preserved. I could have kept it out and kept it. But yeah, there was a lot of ice then. It was, we spent all our time outdoors. Mom never worried about us, you know, we were always outdoors with skating or... During the winter months, we built a little lean-to down there. We got some potatoes, bannock, mostly potatoes and bannock. We'd cook some potatoes in the ashes of the fire and lots of bannock. And we had tea and coffee, so a little lard can. We'd heat the water and drink of that and skate all weekend. Mm. And a lot of times in the evening. Because you could skate right down the river. I used to skate to school at Salmon Arm West. Go up the river and just by the bridge there. And then you had Palmer's Creek, skate up the creek. And then there was a ditch right to the school. And I'd skate right along there and skate right to school.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a fun time.
Yeah, yeah.
It was cold, but, you know, we adapted to it.
Yeah.
And in the summer months, we camp down by the river, go fishing at nights and build rafts, play cowboys and Indians. And because we got westernized a little bit by the movies. And it's funny, you know, when I think back about it, nobody wanted to be the Indian. We all wanted to be the cowboy because they were the good guys.
Oh, yeah.
That's how, you know... That's how we were really brainwashed. Because mm-hmm. all the movies we've seen, the Indians were kayaking around and some John Wayne or somebody would bring his gun there and he'd have a gun that held about 500 bullets in it. Every time he fired one shot, about 50 Indians would fall over. But that's how brainwashed we were,
yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. But we had a lot of fun down there, you know. We had a dog that looked after us. We went go out to building rafts. We'd be rafting all over the lake and swimming. And it was just a great time. You know, the river was deep. We'd dive in there. We had fishing lines, you know, no pole, wooden pole and sinkers and worms and... fish lines and catch our fish and cook it by the fire. And what we did was the one time we even, I got to thank the, I don't know who it was that was trying to get the geese to lay their eggs over in the Delta. They put up these big wash tubs. And they didn't take... So we took one of them down, we cut a hole in the front and then punched a bunch of holes on top, and that was our stove. It worked really good. We could boil or fry our food right on it.
Yeah.
And now I think people are sorry now. The geese are laying their eggs around here now and they're pooping all over the lawns and all over the place. Can't get rid of them now.
Yeah.
And they're here all year round now. So they got their wish.
Yeah, they certainly did.
But, you know, growing up was something you know, we didn't have TVs. We were the first ones to get a TV. My dad got a little bit of money from down the States for selling his land, because down there the natives could sell their land, get a little bit of money, and he got the power in. And first TV on the reserve, and every Saturday, Sunday, a lot of people come to visit. Hockey night in Canada. Then on Sundays was Bonanza and Ed Sullivan. So everybody came to the house then, and we always had a house full on weekends, so it was quite the experience.
Yeah.
It was always our turn to always go out there and turn the antenna. I think a lot of people would remember back the old days when they had to turn to go outside, the wind would blow the antenna around, you'd lose your station. So, but that was part of growing up, you know. I wouldn't trade for everything, because we knew every trail up in the hills. We knew every one down by the river, you know, because we spent the majority of our time out in the land, I think. I think it was a way of the old people, you know. Kids knew how to utilize their time and learn different things out in the land. So, but not being a cowboy, though.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, it's time for Sawachi. That means to ask a question. Yeah. So this is a question that kind of relates to the, you know, what things happened in the winter. And this silly question came to you from an anonymous person a while back, but I thought it was appropriate. What did your people do for Christmas?
Back, I think about 30, 40 years ago, I was asked that question. People didn't realize, you know, that we didn't have Christmas. But I think we get so used to doing it now, where traditionally we didn't, because it's a Christian thing. And we were heathens, remember? So they kept asking me that, and I kept telling them, you know, that we didn't have Christmas. And I think because of that isolation in pit houses, the winter homes, I think our people, just like I talked about before, you know, they spent all evening visiting one another and eating, and then out comes maybe the drums, singing, maybe dancing, and storytelling, and the laughter that went with it. That's why I say, you know, maybe it was Christmas all winter long, because, you know, they were enjoying each other's company, the laughter. And but when I was thinking about it, I changed the story around. I started thinking about our Chiptakwala, our stories, creation stories. So I tell people, maybe the coyote came and he went up to see the little people up Mount Ida. He got them to build toys. Then when the toys were ready, coyote went up there with his birch bark baskets and filled it up. And he went around to all the pit houses delivering the toys. So, but you know, it's some of the questions that people ask me, you know, but they forget our culture was different. And because I always wonder about it, because our spirituality was taken away. And I think the closest I could ever come is I put a lot of faith in our traditional sweats, because I go up there a lot of times, and when I'm angry or, well, mostly full of anger because my stomach's tied in a knot. When I go up there, I do my meditation and I do my sweats. Then when I come back from there, the knot in my stomach is gone. And growing up, I think I was full of anger. And I think the sweats really take it away from me. Sometimes I think I sweat too much and I don't know how to get mad anymore. To me, I think some of the spirituality that I think our people believed in. Because I don't ever remember them saying that we have a hell, you know, a bad place where our people go to. I've never heard of anything like it. a lot of our elders say, well, if you don't make your peace with the Creator to go to the spirit world, you take the shape of an animal and you roam around that way until you make atonement and you're allowed into the spirit world. That's why my grandmother used to say, well, whenever there's a deer or a bear or something walking around, don't shoot it. It might be a spirit of somebody who passed away. They haven't made atonement yet. You know, somebody who died unnatural or did something kind of bad. I think there's no such thing as being really bad. I think murder was one of them, the worst ones. And what they did was they banished somebody who did that real bad, and he had to go out in the land and live by himself, because other bands would see him traveling by himself. They know he did something bad, so they wouldn't really accept him into their band. So that was, banishment was one of the worst things that they could tell. But, you know, it's for a minor one. They take the shape of an animal, and until they made atonement, then they're welcome back in the spirit world. So I don't think we had any, something like, oh, we burn and you turn eternal fire. And but anyways, that's part of it. But spirituality, I think, is something that we've lost a long time ago. But believing in the land and looking after it, mm-hmm. I think, is important.
I'm very curious about spirituality, so maybe next time we get together for a conversation, we can talk about that. And some of the Chiptaquila, some of the creation stories, they're so wonderful. Yeah. And I'd love to hear more about that. Thank you, Louis. It's been a really lovely conversation today. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah. Yes, Kutatua.
Cook's gem.